Hello, this is Elton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So we begin our weekly perusal of the Triangle Business Journal just inside the front cover at the biz page. And under the heading of development, we find the article magazine touts NC's job growth in 2020. 2020 can't leave fast enough for many of us, but for the state of North Carolina, there's actually something to celebrate when it comes to economic development. North Carolina recently tied with Georgia for the number one spot in Site Selection Magazine's top state business climate list. The Tar Heel State had been in the number two spot for five straight years. The news comes as, so far in 2020, 11 firms have made commitments to bring 300 or more jobs to the state in exchange for incentives. Combined, the 11 have pledged more than 8,600 jobs in exchange for nearly $486 million in incentives from the state. That includes the thousands of jobs offered by Centene Corporation, and the nearly 900 pledged by BioAgilytics recently. And under the heading of Texas Travel Giant plans Big Center in Orange County, we find the following information. A Texas gas station and travel center giant with a chain of massive travel destinations through the South has its eye on Orange County for its first North Carolina location. Earlier this year, Buc-ee's filed a rezoning in Orange County for a 104-acre travel destination situated along the Interstate 4085 corridor in central North Carolina at exit 161. Now, the company specializes in large centers like these along major freeways, catering to travelers throughout the country. It's exciting for now and for the foreseeable future. This is going to be the only one in North Carolina, says Stan Beard, head of real estate development at Buc-ee's. There may be others in the future, but I think this is a good stretch and a representable stretch for the customer base. Plans call for a Buc-ee's travel center and convenience store, as well as retail space, office, medical office, and industrial space, a hotel, a bank, and 40 acres of green space. Buc-ee's expects to bring around 200 jobs with this project. And under the heading of New Life comes the article Gastonia Ties Baseball and Development. Some of the former mill towns in western North Carolina, think Kannapolis and Hickory, are finding innovative ways to jumpstart their downtowns. Now Gastonia is trying to catch that wave with a new ballpark scheduled to open next year and a development surrounding it. At the center of the $26.2 million Franklin Urban Sports and Entertainment District is a new ballpark to replace the aging Sims Legion Park. Also looking to add life to the area is a redevelopment of an old Trenton Mill building that will become 89 loft apartments. And a former Coca-Cola bottling plant there will be occupied by Dirty Bull Brewing Company, which is based at 206 Broadway Street in Durham. And under the heading of rents comes the article, and speaking of the rising cost of living in Durham, Durham's getting pricier, and not just on penthouses. The Apartment Guide's October rent report is out. Durham had the second biggest rent increase in regards to two-bedroom apartments across the U.S., with a 46.8% jump year over year. St. Louis was first. Durham was also the city with the third highest rent increase of one-bedroom apartments in the U.S. at 33.9%. St. Louis and Plano, Texas topped that category. Nowhere to be found in the report, Raleigh and Charlotte. Nationally, rent prices have increased modestly year over year, according to the report. And since that article alluded to the rising cost of living in Durham, we find the interesting article, Swank Penthouse on the Market Now in Durham. So if you're looking for a penthouse, this might fill your bill. You might not think of Durham as a place for swank penthouses, but one's on the market that might change your mind. A penthouse that sweeps across nearly 8,000 square feet is for sale in a downtown Durham building that dates from the 1920s. The location at 300 East Main Street includes a 30-foot cathedral ceiling, a 2,400-square-foot open space as a great room, and a staircase leading to the mezzanine. No expense has been spared during its metamorphosis from once respected, though long-forsaken meeting place to the world-class residence it is today, says the listing by Hodge and Cottrell Sotheby's International Realty. The penthouse takes up the top two levels of a four-story building that was renovated from 2014 to 2016. The price? A cool $4.5 million. And finally, on the biz page today, under the heading of eSports, comes the article, New League Links Parents and Kids. A triangle entrepreneur is looking to tap into the eSports boom with a novel idea. Parents and kids can be involved together. Moms and dads have long served as soccer and baseball and football coaches as a way to be involved with their children. And Jay Melamed, who has four young children, thought the concept could work for eSports as well. He swam in college at Goucher College in Maryland, got his MBA at UNC Chapel Hill, and had senior roles in a number of commercial real estate firms before launching XP Sports in August. His wife, Eva, has some Code Ninjas franchises where children learn to code by playing video games. With the pandemic, of course, Jay Melamed says, these kids game all the time. They want to play video games all the time. So he wrote a business plan for setting up leagues where different teams would compete against each other and work with the Positive Coaching Alliance to help coaches develop the best ways to lead their children and teams. Thanks to the Code Ninjas collection, the XP League already has 14 franchises and is about to jump to 17. The matches involve esports competitions that involve skill but also collaboration, which rewards the stronger teams. Melamed has written out simple-to-follow plans for anyone who might want to launch a league of their own. We want our franchisees, our league commissioners, to have a league in a box, he says. The big draw for parents, of course, is they get involved with children who would be online anyway. The parents get amped about it because they are connecting with their kids in a way that they haven't before, Melamed says. Well, now we turn the page and we arrive at the tech and eco-development page. The heading is Interest Remains, and the article is entitled NC Still Buying for New Jobs and Big Projects. Despite a global pandemic and the uncertainty surrounding the presidential election, companies from across the globe continue to consider North Carolina as they plan expansions and relocations. Chris Chung, CEO of the state's top recruitment engine, the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, admits 2020 has been different. Instead of site helicopter tours, the state has deployed drones. Several site negotiation meetings have been replaced altogether by Zoom conferences. Data from the EDPNC show more big job wins could be coming to North Carolina as companies continue to actively negotiate projects across the state. As of October, there were more than 180 companies in the pipeline, those looking to potentially expand or relocate operations in the state. The largest share at 29 of projects in the pipeline are manufacturing. That's followed by food, beverage, and agriculture at 25, biotech and pharmaceuticals at 22, automotive at 13, and textiles at 12. Just 20% of the recruitment and expansion pipeline is coming from outside of the United States, significantly lower than what's typical. Foreign direct investment, usually called FDI, has been about one-third of the state's pipeline over the past few years, a phenomenon Chung has linked to trade rhetoric. Foreign companies looking to bypass trade barriers were looking to invest in the U.S., and North Carolina's business climate and talent pipeline kept putting it on shortlists. But while it may be lower than in years past, FDI is still active. For example, firms based in India are eyeing North Carolina for 4 active projects. 3 of them are in the pharmaceutical arena. Altogether, ADPNC is looking at 37 active projects being considered by foreign entities. What isn't happening, however, is activity at the state's mega sites. None of the projects seriously eyeing the state currently are mega projects in the 1,000-acre range. But that can change, Chung says. In an hour, we can get a phone call. There's just not a lot of those super massive projects. And under the heading of Thinking Big comes the article Nuvotronics Vision for Triangle Expansion. After much and back and forth negotiation, Nuvotronics made it official October the 30th, picking Durham for a 130-job expansion. And it could be just the start. Martin Amin, vice president and general manager of Nuvotronics, says the company has a much bigger vision for the triangle. Amin says the expansion comes out of a major market explosion. After years of testing, its technology is ready to scale to high-volume production, he says. Amin points to the ongoing expansion of Internet of Things technologies requiring ever higher bandwidth. Our technology allows you to start to access the other part of the spectrum called millimeter wave, he says. That's going to be the next generation of 5G to be able to do that. Nuvotronics was founded in 2008, but didn't arrive in the triangle until 6 years ago, bringing with it bullish job growth projections. The firm would go on to move its headquarters to Durham from Virginia, settling into a space formerly occupied by Nitronix. In 2019, San Diego's Cubic Corporation bought it out in a $64 million deal, promising even more growth in the region. Nuvotronics Platform Center is on a technology it calls Polystrata, developed with the help of Department of Defense dollars. The technology allows a company to design and produce uniquely packaged radio frequency devices, such as antennas, filters, and combiners, all of which are components of its parent company's own advanced technology product offerings. Now that the announcement is official, Amin says the firm has broad aspirations. He adds that, with the expansion, he hopes to better partner with area universities. He says relocating equipment to a local university where students could design fundamental RF systems is even a possibility down the line. And a short article here under the heading of spinoff, Raleigh has a new publicly traded company. A long-planned split has given Raleigh a new publicly traded company. Vontier spun out of Washington-based Fortive Corporation last month, becoming a standalone company based in Raleigh that, according to CEO Mark Morelli, is ready to capitalize on the attractive $27 billion mobility market. On the firm's first earnings calls recently, Morelli said the company has significant runway for disciplined M&A. The next 10 years of mobility will bring more change in the way that people and products move than any other decade since the invention of the automobile, he said. The company, made up of Fortive's transportation and mobility business, reported net earnings for its third quarter of $134 million, a 25% increase from what the unit reported a year ago. Now we turn the page to the real estate pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And the first article up under the heading of Beefing Up is Connecticut Firm Adds to Triangle Portfolio with Apartment Buy. A global investment firm with an eye for Triangle assets has made its latest purchase in the region, paying $25.7 million on an apartment complex in Northwest Raleigh. Greenwich, Connecticut-based Starwood Capital Group part of Starwood Property Trust, recently bought the River Birch at Town Center Apartments through an LLC controlled by Starwood Real Estate Investment Trust affiliate. The property features 176 units across a collection of two-story buildings, situated on 11.6 acres at 2611 Torquay Crossing off Old Wake Forest Road and west of Triangle Town Center. Amenities at River Birch include a clubhouse, fitness center, pool, playground, and others. Unit layouts include 1, 2, and 3-bedroom options. The apartment's website lists a 2-bedroom unit for $1,100 a month. The seller, Devonshire LP, bought the land in 1995 for $640,000, according to county records, and opened the apartments in 1996. This purchase is Starwood's latest in the Triangle. In February, the company paid $31 million for the 264-unit overlook at Sims Creek Apartments in northeast Raleigh near the WREL soccer park. Last November, Starwood paid $111.25 million for the exchange on Irwin. That property features 265 multifamily units and 96,949 square feet of commercial space in Durham across from Duke University's main campus. And under the heading of New Home comes the article, Raleigh Real Estate Firm Lands Downtown Headquarters. Raleigh-based Monarch Realty Company officially opened its new offices at 213 Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh recently as the company gears up for explosive growth planned for the year to come. Altogether, the new office features 5,000 square feet of office and meeting space, with co-working style space on the ground floor for Monarch brokers and private office, and meeting space above. The move comes as the company looks to expand from around 20 brokers currently to well over 100 in the coming year. "We're really hoping to lead the charge back," said Chris Moore, broker in charge at Monarch Realty Company. And under the heading of First in C comes the article, as holidays approach, Amazon opens new 4-star store at Crabtree Mall in Raleigh. After months of preparation, Amazon has officially opened its premier North Carolina 4-star store inside Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh. The Seattle-based tech giant held the store's grand opening October 29th, showcasing the new retail concept that offers a rotating inventory of highly rated products from Amazon.com. The new store features many of the company's top-rated, top-selling, and new and trending products. And last article on our real estate page is construction to begin on Cary's $1 billion Fenton project. After years of planning and preparation, the developers behind a massive $1 billion mixed-use project in Cary are gearing up to begin construction soon. On November the 12th, partnering firms Hines, Columbia Development, and USAA Real Estate will launch construction on the first phase of Fenton, a mixed-use development complete with plenty of retail, office, and multifamily space across 92 acres in Cary. The development will include a Wegmans. Plans for the first phase call for 350,000 square feet of retail space, 200,000 square feet of Class A office, 357 luxury rental homes, and a 12-story hotel. The first phase is expected to open in April of 2022, with the multifamily units expected to open no later than June 1st, and the hotel expected to trail as well. The Wegmans will be complete with a tabletop parking lot similar to the company's setup at its Midtown Raleigh location. CMX Cinemas is also planning to open a 6-screen, 35,000-square-foot dine-in theater. The new space will also feature a collection of local chefs, including Michael Lee, Scott Crawford, Ford Fry, and Steve Palmer. The developers plan to build the office space on spec as leasing efforts get underway, and they unveil plans for a luxury multifamily building earlier this year. Hines is in talk with several potential third-party hotel developers. Future phases will feature a collection of taller Class A office buildings and corporate campuses. Hines director Paul Zarian says the companies plan to start work in the next phase sometime after opening the first. The next phase could start earlier than expected if a large tenant signs on to office space, he says. Altogether, the project is entitled for around 2.5 million square feet, with the first phase taking about 1 million of that. Next, we turn from the real estate pages of this week's journal to the healthcare pages of this week's journal, and under the heading of expanding comes the article, Syneos Health Buys California Competitor. A Marshall contract research organization has acquired a competitor that focuses on emerging biopharma business. Syneos Health has scooped up Centeract, a California-based CRO that works in more than 60 countries around the globe. The company also has offices in Marshall. The acquisition promises to bring significant revenue synergy opportunities, according to Syneos, as it looks to use the deal to target the small and mid-sized customers that Centeract counts among its clients. Financial deals were not released. Centeract is one of the leading mid-sized, late-stage-focused CRO platforms with global reach and an attractive focus on the highest growth customer segment in the CRO space, fueled by near-record funding levels, Syneos CEO Alistair MacDonald said. With Centeract, we will strengthen our leadership across the entire SMID, that's a small to mid-sized capitalization, if you didn't know that, the entire SMID category, while we continue to drive growth along large biopharma customers. Syneos said Centeract employs about 700 across North America, Europe, the Asia-Pacific, and Africa, and has supported more than 4,000 Phase 1 to 4 clinical trials across 26,000 sites in more than 60 countries. Centeract will maintain its brand and operate as a business unit of Syneos. And under the heading of contract research, looks like a lot of contract research articles this week, comes the article, Why BioAgilytics Picked Durham for an Expansion with 875 Jobs. After seeing business boom, a Durham contract research organization says it picked its hometown over other life science hubs for a major expansion because it believes the region will be the best place to hire hundreds of workers in the future. BioAgilytics plans a $61.5 million, 878-job expansion. CEO Jim Datton says the move comes during a period of rapid growth, and the high job number is a continuation of its growth pattern. According to Datton, the company hired more than 40 employees in its first quarter, 66 in the second quarter, and more than 60 in the third quarter. Currently, he says the company is looking for another 70 employees. He says he expects we'll be hiring several hundred people next year. We've been fortunate that the business is strong for us, and we're doing over a dozen different COVID treatments as we speak, trying to help our pharma and biotech partners get a vaccine or treatment to marketplace, Datton says. We've got a lot of good tailwinds right now. BioAgilytics has just over 500 employees. Danton anticipates getting to more than 1,200 employees in Durham alone. It has operations in Boston, and it considered Massachusetts as a location for the expansion. As part of the North Carolina expansion, BioAgilytics is eligible for up to $18.8 million over 12 years through a job development investment grant approved by the state. Tied to the grant is a job requirement over a 7-year period, but Datton doubts it will take that much time. That number's conservative, says, about the time frame. I think we're going to do it quicker than that. According to state records and Datton, North Carolina was competing primarily with the Boston-Cambridge area. Ultimately, Datton says BioAgilytics thinks recruiting in the Triangle is a better investment. It was pretty funny. I was talking to one of the state officials in Massachusetts, and he said, "Hey, I know our weather sucks. I know traffic is bad. I know the cost of living is terrible here, but," Datton says, laughing, "I thought those are three great reasons that we love North Carolina." Next, we come to the cover story for this week's issue of Triangle Business Journal, and that story is entitled Campus Crunch. 2020 has been a difficult year for most businesses, from restaurants faced with empty tables, hospitals delaying profitable procedures or event spaces questioning whether they will again cater to crowds. Few industries have escaped the financial pressures that came with COVID-19. But that wide-reaching effect spells particular trouble for the modern university, which has spent recent decades building a range of education-related or even unrelated services into their business model, increasingly looking to these auxiliary services as the driver for the majority of their revenue. And while the trouble universities and colleges across the country have faced in recent months is well known, the worst may yet be on the horizon. With the auxiliary business lines hemorrhaging money and their enrollment battles ongoing, universities may be looking to state and federal dollars to bail out their expensive overhead. But the problem is that the same pandemic that shut down their businesses also shut down much of the tax revenue, creating a budget squeeze at state levels that means there may be fewer dollars to spread around. Some experts point out that university funding could be a prime target for lawmakers looking to shave off funding. Ultimately, given the impact that I think state budgets in general are going to feel, the more reductions there are to state revenues from sales tax, from income tax, from corporate taxation, that does wind up falling more heavily on higher ed, says John Quinterno, the founder of South by North Strategies and an adjunct professor at Duke University. Only because higher ed is really the one item in the state budget that's truly discretionary. And with their budgets threatened and education delivery models being fundamentally reimagined, universities may be forced to make changes that, while initially were emergency cost-cutting decisions, could have a lasting legacy on the higher education industry. According to an American City Business Journal's analysis of student-related revenue at U.S. universities, a 50% reduction in auxiliary enterprises revenue could cost Triangle Higher Education more than $340 million collectively. I think there will be three kinds of universities that will emerge from the pandemic, says Kevin Guskowitz, Chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill. The stubborn universities that will go back to trying to do business as usual. A second type that will learn a bit, change some things along the margin, but potentially go back over time to doing things as they had previously. The third type is the kind I hope Carolina will become, a reimagined university. The issue is not just something that concerns educators and administrators. For the same reason higher education finds itself attacked on multiple fronts, so too will changes to it ripple throughout multiple sectors of the economy and local communities. A university deciding to change how it operates will not just change educational opportunity in a vacuum. In the case of the mega universities dotted across North Carolina, it could also mean a change to the local hospital system, the public-private enterprise that employs hundreds across the triangle, or even one of the region's biggest landlords. What we do know for certain is that the year ahead will bring deep financial and operational challenges, Peter Hans, the new president of the UNC system, told the Board of Governors in its last meeting in late October. Right now, it's impossible for experts and administrators to say what the actual fiscal effect will be on higher education, with the impact of the coronavirus fluctuating greatly depending on how campuses are and will be inundated with cases and how long the situation continues. But Quinterno says it's also difficult to say because of the diversified revenue streams that are funding the state's largest universities and that these almost discrete lines of business are often cross-subsidizing other parts of the university's operation. Regardless of what lies ahead, the impact of the year is likely in the hundreds of millions, With the state's public universities calling an early end to their on-campus fall semesters, calling off their summer semesters, and operating with, at best, truncated spring semesters, even the campuses least affected by COVID-19 have seen losses in revenue from on-campus housing contracts, athletics, and the various commercial operations that rely on students. This so-called auxiliary enterprises revenue is an important line item in the budget of any university, but especially so at the state's largest schools. That number could continue to rise if COVID-19 disruptions persist, something the UNC system is already preparing for. Describing the budget priorities for the system at the October meeting of the UNC Board of Governors, James Holmes, chair of the Budget and Finance Committee, forecasted funding needs in the event contingency funds are needed for the continuing extraordinary cost incurred because of the coronavirus, and in the event of a significant decrease in revenue and receipts during the latter half of the current fiscal year and for fiscal year 2021-2022. Just from its decision to move students off campus during the spring semester, the system had to refund more than $188.9 million to students across the state for on-campus room and board, representing just half of the semester. Some experts say that the best-case scenario for universities still means disruptions ahead as the nation continues to fight surges in cases and awaits a vaccine. Best-case scenario is that things start to return to normal for academic year 2022, says Gregory Brown, the director of UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Institute of Private Enterprise. This would require an effective vaccine widely adopted, and the number of national cases falling to less than 1,000 or so per day. Worst-case scenario is probably a quickly mutating virus that's hard to eradicate and prevents traditional gatherings of people. This could be a very prolonged disruption. Presuming even the best-case scenario, universities have been looking for ways to cut costs and combat the fallout of other revenue sources. With the prospect of another disrupted spring looming, the most ambitious of cost-saving strategies may be yet to come. Experts note that because such a large portion of revenue impact is related to students on campuses, the universities that have managed to mitigate widespread cases will naturally have fared better than those such as UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, and East Carolina universities that have had to suspend in-person undergraduate courses. For those universities, ensuring a return to some semblance of normal in the spring semester is vital to restoring auxiliary revenue streams, but it is unlikely it will completely cure the issue. In fact, Duke University, one of the best-resourced universities in the region, and one that has managed to avoid a flare-up of cases on its campus thus far, just announced a round of layoffs at the beginning of October, signaling far and wide that even the most robust institutions are far from immune. And looking at university budgets, some say there's little room for cost-cutting methods outside of layoffs. The thing about higher education is that it's a very human resource-intense operation, Quintero says. It requires a lot of bodies, a lot of skilled bodies. So much of their budget is built into personnel costs. Regardless of what universities do to reduce operating costs, some say it may not be enough in isolation. For large public universities, I don't think there is a sustainable cost-cutting model if they can't return to something like normal operations in academic year 2022, Brown says. They will need government support of some sort to continue providing quality undergrad education. But whether that government support is coming is anyone's guess. Jenna Robinson, the president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, says that she anticipates that universities in the state will make requests for more relief funds. I expect they will request special coronavirus relief funds instead of including these needs as part of their usual requirements, she says. However, since tax revenue is also down, I do not expect that there will be enough money in state coffers to fully fund the post-COVID needs of all our state agencies. She says, however, that the more she sees of state funding numbers, the more she thinks the state will be able to do. But as Robinson notes, public higher education is far from the only state agency that has funding needs or has been struggling during the pandemic, and many of the others have the advantage of being mandated services. A lot of the state budget is locked in. We do need to have a court system, for example. And over the years, there have been a lot of reductions to the parks and cultural services and all that. So really, the only somewhat sizable, truly discretionary budget item is higher education, Quinterno says. But that's a common problem that you see after every major recession, really, since the late 70s and early 80s. You'll see state funding for higher education fall after every recession, and then it doesn't necessarily rebound during the subsequent expansions. He says that often federal funds can sometimes slow down that pattern, but eventually higher education takes a hit. Jay Chaudhry, a North Carolina state senator from Wake County, says he and his colleagues are acutely aware of the serious financial challenges due to the pandemic that the institutions are facing. He says he believes that while the state has not yet received additional budget revenue projections, he believes the top priority will be supporting these institutions so they can carry out their core academic missions. I believe Congress must play a key role in helping fund personal protective equipment and mitigating the spread of COVID-19, Chaudhry says. We should also allocate state budget dollars, too, in helping with such efforts. For onlookers like Quinterno, the former is a big question left to be seen. The budget question is still very much up in the air about what impact this will have on states' revenues. And the big question mark is the federal government going to step up at some point with funds for state and local budget support, which would potentially offset cuts to higher education and other government services, he says. I think that piece hasn't really come into focus yet, and that's probably the big shoe that is waiting to drop. The answers to these questions, as well as the adaptions already made in response to the pandemic, will likely have a profound effect on both the near-term and long-term model of universities. Notably, many point out that universities best suited to thrive in the pandemic are the mega universities across the state with massive endowments and diversified revenue streams that make them more resilient to any single issue in one business segment. Smaller institutions that are more reliant on the basic model of higher education, namely putting students in classrooms, have been forced to be more deliberate in ensuring their campuses remain open during the pandemic, while research universities, especially those well-equipped with medical and technology dollars flowing from the federal government in response to COVID-19, have additional padding from enrollment woes. But even the largest universities, such as the UNC system flagships, forced to suspend in-person instruction, have seen a fundamental shift in their educational delivery model through the widespread adoption of online learning. That shift, experts say, will likely be a permanent change to the industry and provide innumerable options to explore as the university struggles with predicted revenue issues. There will be more permanent tech-enabled educational options, Brown says. It has forced faculty to provide education in formats many would not have tried otherwise. This could be a lasting benefit in terms of quality and efficiency for some schools. From consolidating services or classes across entire systems, or limited the necessity for more physical space on campuses, the growth of the online campus could lead university leaders to reimagine long-term needs for their campuses and may even lead to a slowdown in real estate purchases, expansion of on-campus services, or an increased interest in online degrees for students physically far from their traditional enrollment pools. Everything is on the table, Guskowitz says. We've got our finance team working closely with a number of people on campus to look at all the options, to be sure that we're well positioned to offset whatever type of shortfall we might be faced with. Others across the system point out that increasing financial pressure for smaller universities and large systems could use it as a catalyst to improve quality by consolidating some services. Joe Coletti, a senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh, says examples of this could include using online lectures for certain classes benefited by smaller breakout sessions led by graduates or adjuncts. There's an opportunity for schools to rethink what they're doing and ask the deeper questions about how we're structured and what we're trying to accomplish, he says. It'll vary by campus about how much they're willing to do that. But importantly, experts also say that the pandemic experiments have also reinforced something contrary to these possibilities. Students still see much of the value of higher education tied to the traditional on-campus college experience, something vital to the health of an industry that has built its revenue model around that very experience. At the same time, though, others wonder if the pandemic is changing how people see these institutions and if it is revealing how far from the atypical university some have become. These enterprises have gotten so big, you wonder to a certain degree, is education the nice face we put on this operation, which has really just become this huge conglomerate of which education is just one small part, Quinterno says. We have this idea of teaching and learning, and you're on the quad with the funny professor with the pipe and corduroy jacket. But these are huge businesses that are being run on very corporate lines in a very corporate way. Maybe that's what we want them to be. Maybe that's not what we want them to be. But maybe there's a question about if that's what they're going to be, should we be subsidizing them in the way we are? Frequent listeners to this program will know that after we read the cover story, we turn to the executive voice column. And so we do that again this week. And this week's executive voice belongs to Kevin McLeod. Armed with a certified public accountant designation and 5 years of professional experience at public accounting firms, Kevin McLeod pivoted to oversee finances in the senior living industry in May of 1992 and hasn't looked back. For the past 2 decades, he's been in the C-suite at Carolina Meadows, the Triangle's largest continuing care retirement community. He first served as its chief financial officer and has been its president and CEO now for nearly 15 years. Carolina Meadows currently serves 607 residents in independent living, 60 residents in assisted living, 13 residents in memory care, and 70 residents in skilled nursing. It also serves 117 residents in its early advantage program for a total of 865-plus residents. The Chapel Hill community employs 480 full and part-time associates. So here's the Q&A of the executive voice column. What brought you to Carolina Meadows? Public accounting was a good learning experience, but never where I felt was living up to my ultimate calling. I was encouraged by my pastor, John Kimmons, to apply for a job that he knew about in a retirement home. I like to tell folks that it was by divine intervention that I landed in elder care and senior services, and I truly believe it was divine intervention, since it's been such a rewarding career since day one. Rob Boning was a CEO who recruited me to Carolina Meadows. He became my dear friend and mentor over the next 7 years. He became sick with terminal cancer and passed in October of 2005. In January of 2006, the board of directors appointed me as the new CEO. So what are your goals for Carolina Meadows? Our short-term plans include completing construction of 40 additional hybrid homes that will open in June. That will push our resident population living on campus to around 825 residents. Our board has given us the green light to continue planning for repositioning the existing skilled nursing facility, which will continue over the next 2 to 3 years with planned construction by 2024. With the pandemic, it has forced us to put technology at the forefront of our planning. the ability to utilize innovative technologies so that we can better communicate and support our residents and associates in today's environment is paramount to our continued success. Longer-term goals include possible development of a new senior living product through partnerships with like-minded innovators who desire to bring art, music, and dance to the senior living arena. We had been in high-level conversations with a very interesting partner, but the pandemic has temporarily slowed that progress, that process. So how has your facility handled the pandemic? We were way ahead of the CDC and the NC Department of Health and Human Services when the pandemic first began. We locked down the campus and began wearing masks, screening staff, and practicing social distancing well ahead of when it was required. We implemented a telework program for our administrative associates to work from home as much as possible. We closed down our dining facilities and implemented a daily meal delivery program. We moved all our standing meetings to virtual meetings. We implemented weekly virtual town hall meetings with our residents to keep them informed and to address their concern. We also moved to virtual town hall meetings to keep our associates informed and hear their concerns. We've not laid off or reduced hours for any of our associates. In addition, we expanded our resident shopping program so that our residents could order most of their food and supplies directly from us without having to leave campus. We continue to screen all staff daily, and our skilled nursing, assisted living, and memory care areas remain locked down, except only to essential staff or families in end-of-life situations. We've been allowing for virtual visits and window visits for residents and family members. So what's your greatest professional challenge? To keep our services and products affordable as long as possible, coupled with providing livable wages for our associates, as well as career paths to keep them engaged at every level. What do you do to relax? I'm an outdoors person who loves to hike, hunt, and fish. Hiking is the single most relaxing thing I can do. And finally, excuse me, what books are currently on your nightstand? First of all, I have a Bible, the NASB version, that I turn to often. My other books include A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom in the American Future by Os Guinness, Life Without Lack by Dallas Willard, and 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity by John Lennox. Now under the heading of Second Spike comes the article, Triangle Providers Expect Less Disruption Now. With rising COVID-19 cases comes more strain on medical services, but Triangle providers say they do not expect the disruption seen in the spring. During the early peaks, providers were hit hard financially due to restrictions on elective procedures and a decrease in patients seeking care. But Manish Patel, co-founder and CEO of Carey's Avance Care, says, "Since then, we all have adopted to the reality we are better prepared through PPE staffing and financially, and the patient visit volume has returned to pre-COVID level, aided by COVID testing, and given that we are still seeing a significant amount of virtual visits." That same optimism is seen with the area's largest hospital executives. "We're in a better place now than earlier this year with our supplies of PPE, the key driver in the first suspension of elective procedures, and have been preparing all along for another surge in cases," he says. "Our goal is to remain fully operational." And now from some news around the state comes the article, Virus Continues to Impact State Economy. Economists are in agreement. The U.S. economy's success or failure largely hinges on an unpredictable virus. North Carolina's economy has been slower to recover. COVID-19 case numbers continue to climb. The economy showed a promising rebound in the third quarter. Third quarter gross domestic product grew at 33.1% annual rate and 7.4% over the last quarter, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That doesn't cover pandemic-related losses, but it does make a short-term recovery possible, says John Connaughton, economics professor at UNC Charlotte. He also argues lower death rates are a sign of moving in a good direction. This virus is not as bad as it appears. It's bad, don't get me wrong. I don't want it, Connaughton says. When you look at this thing in the margin instead of in totals, it doesn't look as bad because we're getting better at treating it. Charlotte's faring relatively well, in part due to a booming construction market, says Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo Securities. Residential is booming with rock-bottom rates. Plus, the city already had a good pipeline of commercial projects starting pre-pandemic. Vittner doesn't think the economy is headed for another lockdown or back to the toilet paper frenzy. He's also encouraged by the vaccine research. That doesn't mean the danger is gone. There could be a larger COVID resurgence nationwide. Business performance will depend on the type of business and if customers come back. Gus Foucher, chief economist of the PNC Financial Services Group, says about half the economy is at risk during a shutdown. That includes spending on big items such as cars, consumer spending outside of healthcare, housing and utilities, global exports, business investment. He says the recovery will be weaker as long as people are uncomfortable in gatherings. When I say the economy's in recovery, that doesn't mean the economy's doing well, Foucher says. The state's September unemployment rate rose to 7.3% compared to 6.5% in August. Next, we turn to the back page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find the viewpoint page, and in it, the editor's notebook. That column is entitled, "The Election Winners Must Focus on Lifting Businesses and Individuals." It should come as a little surprise that we have a highly polarized country with citizens split down the middle when it comes to deciding who should lead the nation for the next 4 years. But let's not forget that elections don't make our economic, social, and cultural differences go away. In fact, months of campaigning from federal, state, and local officials to get our attention actually brought all our challenges and opportunities into focus. Now comes the hard part. How do we move forward from here? While results of the presidential contest between Donald Trump and Joe Biden are yet to be certified, most of the state and local election results are final. In North Carolina, we know Governor Roy Cooper was handed the mantle to lead the state. And we know the North Carolina General Assembly will still have a majority of Republicans in both chambers. Cooper and Senator Leader Phil Berger have clashed on many issues in the past, with Berger forcing bills to pass, only to be vetoed by Cooper, who wanted more money for education, health care, and the environment. Because there's minimal change in the makeup of the General Assembly, a side note is that Republicans actually picked up a few seats in the House, it's unlikely the relationship between Cooper, Senate leaders, and the House Speaker will change, but it should. If the Democrats and Republicans do not understand that North Carolina businesses are hurting, and people are increasingly concerned about their jobs and the threat of COVID-19 to their everyday lives, one could argue this election taught them nothing. Exit polls from North Carolina show 80% of the voters who sided with Trump thought they were financially better off than 4 years ago. Conversely, 87% of voters who said they were worse off than 4 years ago sided with Biden. It's not too hard to see the emergence of two Americas right in our backyard. Also, according to the exit polls, 56% of the voters making under $50,000 a year sided with Biden, and 52% of the voters making more than $100,000 sided with Trump. That tells us that while there are some differences, income levels are playing a lesser role in choosing the commander-in-chief, at least in this state. But what's playing a really big role is not a real surprise, and that's where people live in the state and how they vote. More than 66% of the voters living in cities with more than 50,000 people voted for Biden. But almost 60% of the voters living in rural areas and the suburbs went for Trump. That tells us the urban-rural divide continues to change the dynamics of this state. And that may also explain why state lawmakers from rural counties and lawmakers from urban areas offer vastly differing views on what's important for the entire state. Locally, however, there was a big victory on November 3rd for lawmakers and developers alike. the passage of the $80 million affordable housing bond in Raleigh. The bonds will be funded through property tax increases, but more than 78% of Raleigh voters agreed with the strategy. City leaders in recent years have become concerned about the lack of affordable housing in the area and have tried, in a few instances, to strong-arm developers to set aside condos and apartments at new projects at below-market rates. The passage of these bonds will mean city leaders can now develop public-private partnerships with real estate development companies to come up with a fiscally sound plan. It also gives the city some money to buy land strictly for affordable housing. Rehab homes, and in some cases, offer money for first-time homebuyers. This is a great win for the city and the real estate community. It was clear from the way people voted across the country that the economy, COVID-19, and race relations were on the top of people's minds. All these issues are not going away. If we do not find a way to work together in solving the differences in governing, the people who voted on November the 3rd will be the ones that will hurt the most. As for businesses, the impact of COVID-19 will continue to ruin the balance sheets unless there's help from federal, state, and even local lawmakers. Given the size of the problem, with more than 100,000 entities already out of business, our election winners must address this issue immediately before we lose more businesses and more jobs. The people of this state and this country have spoken. Now, let's see whether the choices we made offer a better result. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website. That's ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, call us, 919-832-5138. So long.